Good morning, everyone. Too tall. You are in session 213, Deepening Spiritual Journeys Beyond a Traditional Mormon Paradigm. Thanks, everybody, for being here. And congratulations for surviving your first full day at Sunstone. We're excited to start our Friday sessions. Today, we invite you to celebrate what it means to Mormon as a verb, not a noun. Sunstone invites you to show us how you Mormon. We're striving to build a community where your authentic Mormon experience is recognized as a legitimate Mormon experience, and you are part of it. If you haven't yet, make sure to pull the embroidery thread from your name badge sleeve and trade them with others. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off, and those attending, please be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when you're engaging in the Q&A portion of this session. Those who can't abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave if they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk. This session is 60 minutes long. We ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. And immediately after this session, we ask that you clear the room and speak outside so other presenters can begin preparation for the next session. I'm very excited to introduce this session and Jana. A big fan of both the work that Jana does and the person who she is. You guys are in for a treat. As people's religious worldviews shift, they often go through periods where it's difficult to find fulfillment in church attendance and the spiritual practices of their upbringing. These things can feel empty or even triggering. In this session, Jana will explore framings and practices that can open up possibilities for spiritual deepening, supplementing or replacing those of traditional Mormon worship. Jana is an integral professional coach working with Symmetry Solutions. She specializes in coaching people who are experiencing faith transitions in themselves or loved ones. She's also a student at the Living School under the direction of Richard Rohr, studying contemplative wisdom traditions. She's also a very passionate and engaging person, and I'm excited to turn it over to Jana.
Thank you so much, Allison. Okay. So, as Allison mentioned, I am a student at the Living School, and you will definitely see a lot of Richard Rohr, Cynthia Bergel, James Finley kind of teaching, eking through in my thoughts here. I just kind of want to set an intention. I don't know how to... Allison, can you figure out how to make that shorter? My intention for this session is not to be prescriptive in how everyone should be doing this. I think that spirituality is such an individual journey. And I think that in Western religion, we've gotten maybe a little too prescriptive on how we deepen that connection with the divine. And so really what I want to do in this session is to talk about different framings, a couple of different framings that can help, thank you so much, that can help us, that's a little too short. maybe I'll just use the mic here. I won't use the stand. I like to wander anyway. I like to be free. So as I was saying, I'm losing my train of thought. Okay, so what I want to explore here are maybe some different ways to just spark some ideas for yourself in your own spiritual practices and in your own way of framing your spirituality. So what I'm saying is hold it loosely. The entire thing may not apply to you. There may be parts that do, parts that don't. And I hope that some will help people just supplement what is happening for you in Mormonism, if you're still connected to the church, and can also apply if you're moving on to other types of spiritual exploration. So, start with this quote. It's a lovely quote. I saw this on Facebook and I went, that's so great. I love Thomas Merton. And then realized Thomas Merton didn't really say it. But I still like the thought that if the you of 5 years ago doesn't consider the you of today a heretic, you are not growing spiritually. Okay, I'm going to give a very brief history of Western religious thought and Western thought in general. I just think it kind of sets the stage for how we think about things today. So in the time before, you know, the Enlightenment and other things that we're going to talk about, wisdom centers kind of really started growing up through the religious centers. That's where people were finding their schooling. You know, before the Gutenberg Bible, we didn't even really have written words. There were more oral traditions. It kind of came up through more spiritual roots. Then Christianity comes in, and in 1054, Rome and Constantinople have a little spat, and the church splits into kind of an Eastern and a Western branches of Christianity. In the West, some of these things started happening. So we did get the printing press and the Gutenberg Bible. People started having access to the written word. Martin Luther comes in and starts a whole Reformation, right? And now we have, not only do we have written word and everyone is starting to really internalize these things as rational thought, now we're arguing about it, right? Then we have the Enlightenment. Okay, so the Enlightenment comes along, everything becomes very rational in the West, right? We start following the Greek philosophers, wisdom centers move to the universities, and rational thought is king. This is the way we are trained to think in the West, by and large. And what I would propose is that this has really leaked into our religious thought and the way that we do religion in the West. So there are two, maybe this is a framing that can help us look at the way we look at religion. So with the rational comes dual thought. Okay, dual thought is not a bad thing. It's we have to live in the dual world. The dual thinking is how I know that I'm different from you. I'm separate from you. I'm a separate being. It creates thought through comparison and helps us make meaning in our everyday material world. So words, rational thought, the material, and as we get into religion, truth claims, testimony, the way that we talk about it in the Mormon faith, it's this very either-or concrete, certainty-driven kind of thought. This is not just Mormonism, but Mormonism is very, very dual. On the non-dual side, these are more experiential things that are really hard to put into words. I mean, try to explain to me what it feels like in deep suffering, or having a spiritual experience or an experience of transcendence. The minute you start to put those to words, which are very dual, you realize it's not possible. So there's this other element that we brush around, I think, in Western religion and thought. We talk around it a bit. We give it kind of some lip service. But we don't delve into it quite as much. Eastern religions, you will find really spending lots of time over in the non-dual, right? That's kind of the mystics. We're trying to reach non-dual consciousness, right? What did the mystic say to the hot dog vendor? Make me one with everything, right? This is non-dual thought. Okay, we are so engrossed with the objects or appearances revealed by the light that we pay no attention to the light. This is what tends to happen when you concentrate, when you are communicating your religious and spiritual experiences through a dual lens. This can tend to happen. We tend to concentrate on the institutions. We concentrate on the prophets. We concentrate on the scriptures. We concentrate on everything. And sometimes we can get lost in that and not see what all of that is pointing to. Okay, that's a quick lens of the dual versus non-dual. Now my next lens is development. So This is something that a lot of research has been put toward this in the past maybe 30, 40, 50 years. And what these people who have been studying development have found is that individuals and also groups develop through stages, okay? And they've all tried to put some kind of category to this developmental change. You know, people don't necessarily follow that exactly, you know. But many of these researchers have just kind of tried to define certain stages and what are some of the I'm losing my train of thought here. Some of the characteristics of these different stages. So this is just a big graph to kind of show that these are some of the notable developmental scientists. Graves, Keegan, Fowler is one probably a lot of people have heard of. Who has heard of Fowler here, right? We talk about it a lot in these contexts because he was specifically doing research on the spiritual line. Okay. But if you look at all of them, they actually all line up with the same kind of principles. And the basic principle, and we're not going to get into all of this, we could do a 3-day seminar just on this stuff, but the basic principle is that our perspective gets wider as we grow. So as we start as children, we have a very egocentric, I'm going to put this, egocentric view. We kind of see the world only through our own lens. As we grow and develop, that widens to be more ethnocentric. We can take in our group. We can take in our families. We can take in our little group and how we think. And then we can become more world-centric and take in more different kind of people. We're not so us versus them. We start to see us all as one. And eventually we can get to an integral level that really honors all of it, holds all of it very well. So on the left, these are just kind of the stages of growth based on those states of consciousness, or stages of consciousness. And you'll see on the left echoes of Fowler. You know, this is the spiritual stages fit into these broader categories of development. So there's a magic stage where it's all, you know, very magical. You know, we don't really connect with it. We hear stories, and it's kind of like Santa Claus, and it's, you know. And then we get to a mythic literal phase where we're taking maybe some of the stories in Holy Writ as very, very literal stories that actually happened. The rational stage would be more in that you know, maybe a stage 3. I think in Mormonism we hold the rational stage very, very well. Some other religions, Western religions, not so much. They start to lose a little bit when they get to the rational stage and start having their faith crisis a little earlier. When you look at the Bible as very, very literal, you know, in Mormonism we have a way of holding that a little less literally, so it takes us a little longer. We can be very rational about our scripture for a longer period of time. And then the pluralistic stage and the integral stage. So what we know about Fowler stages, you know, 80% of people get to stage 3 and they stay there for the rest of their lives. And the center of gravity, I would say, in Mormonism is very definitely in a stage 3 construct. So what does that mean? What does that mean? It means that we love structure. It means that we love to have things in common. We like to have an authority figure, and we put a lot of trust in those authority figures. And it's not until we get to more pluralistic stages that we really start internalizing this and really thinking about it and making it our own. Okay, so what's the problem with all of this? The problem with this is it can tend to stunt our spirituality. Richard Rohr has said, the church has neglected its central work of teaching prayer and contemplation, allowing the language of institutional religion itself to remain dualistic and largely argumentative. We talk a lot about creeds. We talk about what we believe. We talk about these very concrete things when we talk about testimony in the Mormon church. He says, we ended up confusing information with enlightenment, mind with soul, and thinking with experiencing. So we're mixing, we're not allowing in that non-dual experience. I don't think Richard Rohr is trying to squash the dual from all religion. I think he's trying to marry them and just add in some more of the non-dual experience. Okay, so how does this apply to us as Mormons? How has all of this set us up for how we are currently thinking about faith? We typically think of faith as pretty synonymous with belief. We talk about faith crisis all the time in this community, and sooner or later people get kind of like, you know, that feels right for a minute, but then it doesn't. I kind of would like to frame this faith crisis as a belief crisis. I think it's more of a belief crisis that people are going through than a faith crisis. But when we call it a faith crisis, and when we wrap up faith with belief, a lot of us think that our only option is then to just throw out the faith if we're having a problem with our beliefs, right? That's a very dual way of thinking. So what phrase do we hear on a Sunday morning more than any other? On the first Sunday of the month. I know, we're all about the certainty. And we're told what our testimony is. We're told, there are the five things that you should know and you should assert to them, right? This is a slide directly from, I totally shamelessly stole it from a... from a person in my ward who had gone to EFY. So this was being taught to the EFY. This is how testimony works with our dimmer switch, and you can go up and down, and if you're not trying, you're gonna dim, and you've got to be doing all the things, and then if you do the things, then you climb the ladder from I don't believe to I know. And I know is the pinnacle. You have arrived, if you know, right? Doubt is really, really far down there, right? So this is another one that I stole from my own ward council. A high councilman brought this was several years ago, just to kind of talk about how faith kind of ebbs and flows throughout our lives, and hopefully we just still have this upward trajectory, so don't get so worried if you kind of start to slack off a little bit. And I think this works really, really well, especially through stage 1 through 3. In Fowler. This works really quite well to explain how this works. This is the part I added. He didn't talk about this, but this happens to some people. And I think it happens quite harshly when you are in a dual religion. You know, Richard Rohr shares the story of when he visited India, and he was asking his host, who was from India, and said, so do you have atheists in India? And he said, no. We don't. We have no atheists. He says, oh, wait, unless they were Christian first. I think there's something to that. When we experience this faith crisis, largely, I think it's because of a couple of things. It's either we're holding things so literally that when we find out maybe there are some issues, this is more complex than we thought, we run across something that gives us some cognitive dissonance, maybe something that we based our testimony on maybe isn't as simple as that, it can cause a huge crash if you're holding things in a very dual way. I think also if you're on a stage of development where things are just opening up for you and you're starting to think beyond your ethnocentric way, that can also bring on deep questions that can lead you into this faith crisis. So the question is, what do you think, if we're going by the EFY thing with doubt down at the bottom, what happens to this graph when you have a faith crisis? Boom! You've fallen off the cliff, right? And the people who love you, who are still, very in the Mormon paradigm of thinking, they tend to see you with some suspicion, right? You have just gone off the cliff, and you feel that way yourself. You feel like you've gone off a cliff. If we stay in this dual way of thinking, this leaves us with two alternating mediocrities, right? You have on the one side, if you hold things in a very dual way, you tend to become very moralistic. This is where we get kind of the check boxes in Mormonism, right? You can get a temple recommend if you check off a lot of really of the necessary boxes. It doesn't really require a whole lot of compassion or inner growth or being a good person or transformation, right? It can. I'm not saying that. I mean, there are many, many, many faithful Mormons who have taken on more of this non-dual thing without knowing it and have deepened. But it's I don't know that you're going to get it a whole lot out of correlated Mormonism. The danger is just flipping to the other side of the coin in a very dual way, and now I check off other boxes. Now I know the history better than you. Now I pat myself on the back and think I'm smart because I know things that you don't know. Neither one requires compassion, and they both tend towards certain thinking and dual thinking. So what if we start widening this? Okay, so the word pistis is the Greek word that in the New Testament was translated into faith. Okay, and this word originally had a little more depth than just belief, just thinking of the creeds. It became very popular in the turn of the 20th century when Darwin was coming on the scene, and we are having new scientific challenges to understanding where we all come from and to religion and to what religion is teaching us. And it became kind of a badge of honor for people, for the faithful to say, I believe. But there's more to this that I think we don't concentrate on, which is trusting God and God's trust in us. It's a relationship. It is more of a non-dual element that we have kind of lost a little bit. I love the definition I found, that it's God's divine persuasion. It's this idea that God is on our side, as Richard Rohr says here. Our faith is not a belief that dogmas or moral opinions are true, but a faith that God is accessible to us and even on our side. Jesus was able to teach and heal people who trusted him as an emissary of God's love, not people who assessed intellectual statements and decided whether they were true or false. Faith is more how to believe than what to believe. So this is kind of a non-dual element that we can start to think about. So what could happen? We don't have to go off the cliff, is what I'm saying. If we can broaden this and take on a larger view and take on a larger definition of what faith is, it opens up all kinds of possibilities, whether you're still on your Mormon journey or not. It opens up possibilities for you. I got rid of the dimmer switch. I don't like the dimmer switch. It's much more messy. And if I could make this a squiggle all over the place, I would. But, you know, it is not a straight line. It's not even a constant spiral, but I like it better. So, you know, what if that graph I showed, what if before the line is more up to stage 3? And how can we describe a little better what is possible after stage 3? You start with knowledge. Then you start to doubt, and you do this over and over and over again. Doubt becomes a constant with you. and what you do with that doubt can help, you know, help you deepen. If you start to wonder, if you start to let go of what you think you know, if you start to be more open to the mystery, if you start to trust in something bigger, then it can lead to transformation and becoming something different. This is how it feels, though. This is how it can feel as you're stepping out. So my point is, this journey is not for sissies. It's hard to do when your center of gravity is here and you're starting to go out on the leading edge of this, and especially when your center of gravity around you holds certainty and holds conformity, it can really feel like this. You feel like you're going it alone. But like I said, I think spirituality is a lonely journey. So what is spirituality? So Brené Brown, one of my new prophetesses, has given us, this is, comes out of her research. Spirituality is recognizing and celebrating that we are all inextricably connected to each other by a power greater than all of us, and that our connection to that power and to one another is grounded in love and compassion. Practicing spirituality brings a sense of perspective, meaning, and purpose to our lives. Does this have to fight with our Mormon paradigm? No, I think most of us are, I think most people, this is why it came out of the research, right, could kind of agree that spirituality holds this. Here's another one by Cynthia Bergel. Spirituality is increasing our capacity to be receptive to something greater, however you define that. Very simple. Just being open to something bigger. Okay, so Reza Aslan, I saw this in him being interviewed by Oprah, actually, on a Super Soul Sunday. And this is, he brought a framing that was really interesting to me because it's so different from how we think about things typically in Western religion. You know, especially in Mormonism, we're trying to assess truth. You know, is it true or is it not? And, you know, if you get the feelings, you know it's true. He comes at this slightly differently. First, he says, I like to ask people three questions. Do you believe in a higher power? And if you don't, you're an atheist, and that's totally fine. But if your answer is yes, I've got a second question for you. Do you want to experience that higher power? And if your answer to that is also yes, then he asks, what rituals, practices, and communities help you connect to and experience that? It's really quite simple. But you can come at your religious world and your spiritual world in a very different way and start to really notice what rituals and practices help you experience that, right? He says he's a Muslim. He's a Muslim not because he's assessed that it's the best, the truest, the one. It's because he really connects to the metaphor of God, for God. The way that they describe God really connects with him, and he loves the beauty of the ritual. He thinks it's great to stop your day five times and pray. That really works for him, helps him connect. So why have a spiritual practice? Why worry about spiritual practices, right? Why don't you just go off and feel good about your spirituality? Spiritual practice is something you do every day that draws you deeper into who you really are by connecting you with your divine or true self. So having spiritual practices can actually help us live into that rather than having this nice idea out there about what spirituality is. A lot of us really want spirituality to be easy and really nice and just help us feel good. And I'm going to show you that that's not always an effective way of connecting. Okay, we don't think our way into a new way of living. We live our way into a new way of thinking. I think this is really backed up by some of the research by Jonathan Haidt, he's a sociologist who really, really, really wanted to be able to show in some way that our rational minds control our worldview. And his research from the Righteous Mind showed it was quite the opposite. Our feelings and our experiences and our worldview really informs how we rationally think. So if you want to really become something, it actually does take some spiritual practice. What neuroscientists are learning is that a new thought is not enough to create a new neural pathway. It creates a possibility, perhaps, but to actually create a new neural pathway, to become something different, to live into something different, to react to the world in a different way, you actually have to feel it in your body. And when you connect to your body and start doing things, then the neural pathways are actually born. So what are some new ways we can look at some of these spiritual practices that we've grown up doing? What's a new way to look at prayer? So I'm not going to go through all of these because I have a limited amount of time. Let's just suffice it to say that this has been scientifically studied, and there are scientifically studied benefits of prayer, even to atheists. Look it up, atheist prayer. It's a thing. You know, it has a lot of benefit. So in this framing of, you know, stages of growth and identity, how we build our own identities, the way people pray reflects their identity and it reflects their growth. And again, I'm not going to totally go through all of this, but how you identify, if you feel like you have no part of God and you're not divine yourself at all and you're just way down here and God's way up there, you're going to be doing a lot of petitionary prayer. You're going to be feeling like you're flawed. You're going to beg for grace. If you're not feeling that divinity, you're going to be seeking for approval or disapproval. And it's not until you start to recognize that you are one with your fellow man and one with God that you start moving into communion in your prayer. I would also say that in the stages of growth, if you're in an egocentric place, you're going to pray for yourself. If you're in an ethnocentric place, you're going to pray for your group. Start noticing in your churches. Start noticing in the Mormon church how ethnocentric our prayers are. They're very ethnocentric. It will tell you where people are by how they pray. If you have a more world-centric view, the prayers start to include a broader group, broader community, the world. Okay, what's another way we can look at wisdom texts? You know, a lot of people, the biggest growing religious community now are the nuns, the ones that are leaving religions and going out on their own. But most people still identify as spiritual on some level. Connecting to some wisdom that has already happened, we don't need to recreate the wheel, I guess is what I'm saying. There's a lot of wisdom in humanity that we've had throughout our history. And I think it's worth looking into. So first of all, broaden your definition of what scripture is. So this is one hint. Now I'm getting into some practical hints of how to do this. Broaden your definition of scripture. Sacred texts from other traditions. Writings from some of the Christian mystics. Poetry at this stage of spiritual development becomes really tasty, especially these mystical poets, the Rumi, Mary Oliver, William Blake, David White. I mean, I can't tell you how often I hear Rumi quoted now, right? He's everywhere. But there's a reason. There are a bunch of other enlightened authors that are even, in our current time period that are really, really rich that I consider scripture. I'm enlightened and I get closer to myself and all of those definitions of spirituality. I'm more open to other people and to the world. So what are some tips for reading these wisdom texts, especially if you are trying to connect to the ones of your youth, if you're trying to connect to the Bible in a new way, if you're trying to connect to the Book of Mormon in a new way, read with new eyes, from your new perspective, from a more world-centric view or wherever you are that's a little more pluralistic, and do it with some curiosity. You can actually have something that has started to feel stale can feel new again. View it as through with a developmental lens, through as a study of man's interaction with the divine, rather than looking at it as God is telling us literally how to do this. I mean, I just see in Sunday school we get ourselves all in a bunch trying to figure out why God told these tribal people he was really happy with them bashing the women and children of their enemies against the rocks. Right? We're really confused by that. As recently as last month, been in a debate about what that's all about. Right? Is it more likely that God really changed a whole lot between then and the New Testament? Or is it more likely that humans developed and understood the divine in different ways, that they were seeing it through the lens of their development? Something to think about, even in the current day, to assume that we are not still developing and that we don't still have, we're not still seeing through a glass darkly, I think is kind of naive. Literalism is always the least helpful reading of any wisdom text. So, read it for the literalism, but then go deeper. Go deeper into what could be here for me metaphorically, mystically. Even as we let go of Santa Claus, we don't have to believe in Santa Claus literally to get the spirit of Christmas out of that story, right? Take time for contemplation. And if you're really looking at this through a Christian lens, I love this using the Jesus hermeneutic, which is a method of interpretation. So when you look at the Old Testament, what did Jesus quote? He didn't quote bashing children against rocks. Spoiler alert, he didn't. He didn't. Okay? Use his bias in your priorities. Love clearly wins. Jesus was a cafeteria, well, he was really a cafeteria Jew, right? But he was a cafeteria Christian. If you look at Luke 4:18 versus Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, you will recognize that he quoted the entire thing and left out the part about vengeance. Just saying. And also, if you really want to, if you want to connect to who God and I think who divinity is, look at Jesus' life, not what humans, again, through our glass darkly, have made of him once he left. If you read the New Testament, you will see a guy who was not all that much about order. And yet, people who do religion love order. People, ordered people are drawn to religion. And suddenly, we make this guy who was kind of a rebel, kind of chaotic, into the policeman in the sky. So, there are a number of mind-body practices that can become part of your spiritual practice. Meditation, journaling, gratitude, yoga, tai chi, nature practice. Really connecting, again, connecting the body to the mind is going to actually help you create new neural pathways. All right, this is the biggest, most challenging part of spiritual work. So this is where spirituality becomes less fun, but maybe more rewarding. And if we're really going to deepen, I don't think you can do it without inner work. And it's something that I don't think we spend enough time on. But I really think that Jesus was pointing to it when he talked about the mote in someone else's eye versus the beam in your own. He's really pointing to the necessity of this. If we're going to get to our really true inner selves, we're going to have to get real with ourselves. So, to that point, mature religion or spirituality comforts the afflicted and afflicts the comfortable. I think most of us assume this comforting the afflicted, we're really drawn to that. That sounds really nice, especially we want to be comforted ourselves. I don't really want to be afflicted. I don't want to be afflicted as part of my spirituality. This is Jacob Needleman was a philosopher and a religious scholar who said, "Don't make a religion out of your better moments." I think we do tend to do this. I'm feeling really spiritual because I'm feeling just really happy and free. And I'm feeling so spiritual. I'm doing my things, I've checked my boxes, and I'm spiritual, right? Picture how people talk about, the religious talk about one another when they say they're really spiritual. And just kind of imagine what that looks like. We do a lot of spiritual bypassing in Western religion and in Mormonism. We use spiritual practices as self-calming, so we can kind of escape and detach from what's hard. It helps us avoid the messiness of our humanity. It helps us shore up a picture of ourselves of having it all figured out. If you have someone who feels like they really have it all kind of figured out in their life, and this is kind of, I totally get this, it's a big red flag that they're spiritually bypassing. They're doing some spiritual bypassing. We're using the mind to control the mind when we're doing this. We're just really controlling our thoughts. We really are kind of just hanging out up here and not really connecting to what is actually happening in our bodies, actually happening in our emotional lives. It gives us an illusion of control and can help us feel like everything is nice and neat, but it leaves us vulnerable. Because when we live in a place of spiritual bypassing, when the challenges really come, when our own humanity starts to rise up to the surface, we don't know how to deal with that. We don't know what to do with it. We have these ideas of atonement and things like that to help us salve that. But unless we really go down deep into ourselves to learn how to make friends with all of us and integrate all of us, not just the good, but the hard and the ugly and the messy as well, we're spiritually bypassing. It disconnects us from our emotions, our senses, our sensations, and all of that, the emotions, the senses, the sensations, the somatic information is all really valuable data for actually integrating and becoming a more whole person and deepening your spirituality. So we'll talk about spiritual integration a little bit. Spiritual maturity is largely a growth in seeing and awareness. Now, we all come up in this really messy human life, and we feel pain. And pretty collectively, we try to find ways to make it stop, make it go away, and we build these personality structures around that. We have our own special coping mechanisms in ways of doing that. And what we're really doing is bending reality. We're distorting reality in some way. We're not seeing ourselves. We're not seeing others. We're not seeing them clearly. So deepening into spirituality can really be getting closer to what our true selves is under all of that ego, all of that personality. So shadow work, shadow and inner work can become an integral part of this. Our shadow is what we refuse to see about ourselves and what we don't want others to see. So part of my shadow would be that I'm lazy. I feel like I'm lazy, and I don't want anyone to see that I'm lazy, so I go really out of my way to prove to everybody that I'm not lazy. Right? One of the ways to start to recognize our shadow, because shadow work is not, it's not easy, but some of the ways to start doing it is to look at your relationships. We are a gift to one another in so many ways, but this is one of the ways. And look for it. Start with your closest relationships. Look to your spouses. Look to your families. Look to the people you're with the most often, and they're going to show you your shadow because they're going to drive you crazy. And when you feel really upset by somebody else, you can be sure you are in your shadow, and you're projecting it all over that person. The thing that is driving you crazy about them is something you're denying in yourself, or it wouldn't bug you so much. So look at what offends you. Our true selves, Richard Rohr says this, our true selves cannot be offended. So if you're being offended, you know you're in your false self. It's an indication. And then how do I scapegoat? Because I want to get out of that. I don't want to see my shadow. I don't want to own this. And so I'm going to scapegoat, and I'm going to make this all your fault. You shouldn't have said that. It was insensitive. And, you know, and now I'm going to call my three friends, and they're all going to agree with me that you suck. And it really, marriage is one big exercise in scapegoating. I look at my three children. They're all close in age. And just their lives together this summer is one big exercise in scapegoating. Once you have faced your own hidden or denied self, there's not much to be anxious about anymore because there's no fear of exposure. It's amazing. You can actually show up as your more real self. You're not afraid of being exposed to yourself or to others. It starts to loosen that. And it helps us stop protecting our persona. This is what we do. We go through life protecting our persona. That's what most people want from us and reward us for, and what we choose to identify with. All right. And I will end with this beautiful thought from James Finley. We are endowed by our Creator with the ability to become aware of and in presence of ourselves, others, and all things. And to me, that is the spiritual journey. We have this capability. We have this, I think, innate thing in us as humans to want to develop and to grow and to become part of something bigger than ourselves and really become connected to one another. And so really this spiritual journey can be about how do we take out the barriers? How do we become closer to our true selves? And what practices help us move into that? And what groups help us move into that? So that's the end of my presentation. I'm hoping to have a good discussion about this at this point. So please feel free to come up. Yeah, is that? Yeah, there she goes. Hopefully it's working. Yeah, so what questions do you have? What's your experience? Come on up. If you can come up to the microphone, that'd be great.
Good morning, Jane. Yeah, Father Tom Roberts here. I come from a very mystical tradition. And what I wanted to ask you was, yes, when you become a priest after education and you do your spiritual work, in our tradition, We have courses in it where mm-hmm. you have a mentor that mm-hmm. acts as your guide, mm-hmm. your self-reflection. You mm-hmm. write self-reflection papers as you move through the mm-hmm. priesthood. Mm-hmm. We're talking to LDS mm-hmm. leaders about these practices as well mm-hmm. to try and help make the LDS, you know, enjoy a richer experience.
Wonderful.
I brought this up to Elder Holland last month mm. in a meeting where they could offer CEUs and things like that to make the priesthood have a richer experience. Would you agree or would you have another model? Because mm-hmm. all of us are required to have a spiritual mentor.
Yeah.
Do you think that that is part and parcel mm. to spiritual success and mm. accountability?
Okay, great, great question. First of all, thank you. Thank you for doing what you're doing, and thank you for speaking to the LDS leaders about this. I think it's really, really important for the church to be able to deepen. And I would say that it is a really, really good model, what you're talking about. You know, this shadow work is not easy. And if I just let everyone loose here to go do their inner work and do that kind of deepening, they're going to go, okay, where do I start, right?
Right.
I mean, we all deepen so much better with mentors and teachers. This is largely why religions stagnate. We've got the center of gravity and the leaders that are kind of in that stage three place.
Sure.
How do we hold people through a deepening? How do we hold people through a maturing? We don't really know how to do that, right? So I think it's critical to have mentors. I think sure. spiritual direction is a beautiful, beautiful thing. I was introduced to it at the Living School. And
right.
yeah, and I just thought, oh my gosh, we need spiritual directors. We need this so much. Yes,
absolutely.
I would love to. I would love to. Honestly, my heart pulls me to it. And let me tell you what happens in my head. I go, none of these Mormons in Utah, I live in Utah, none of these Mormons are going to want or trust a spiritual director. I'm not a man, and I don't have the priesthood. Yeah, it could make people a little like, ugh. So I love that you're talking about this, because especially with a lay clergy like
yes.
we have,
yes.
which has its benefits.
Yes, it does.
This is one of the big downfalls, right? Is we don't have necessarily, it's up to priesthood roulette what kind of mentorship we get.
Well, we have in our seminary someone I could connect you with who's a spiritual director who does our courses. Mm. And it's all over the Christian world.
Wonderful.
And I would love to give you that.
Please talk to me after.
Okay.
Please come
will.
Talk to me.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. This is a glimpse of what it can be. You know, if we can get some ideas of this from the top, from, you know, in our structures, this is what's hard within the Mormon church. We're so hierarchical and we're so structured and we think everything needs to come from the top. But unless you're exposed to these kinds of things that are working to bring people into deeper spirituality with themselves, you know? I don't know. It's hard to do from an institutional place, so we've got to do it from the ground up. Love it. Thank you.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I am actually a bishop currently mm-hmm. in Mormon Church.
Great.
The current kind of flavor of organized leadership mm-hmm. is this new ministry. Right?
Yes.
Which I think is actually a wonderful thing, and it's really
Absolutely.
Just about love, and that's mm-hmm. what everybody's trying to get to, right?
Yes.
There's also things that come out from that that go back to these paradigms of childhood, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these old habits that die hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what we're talking here, I really appreciated your two kind of progressive testimony
mm-hmm.
bit, and I'm sitting here reflecting and thinking, mm-hmm. how do we help to start conversations about 4 and 5 and 6
right.
in an environment that mm-hmm. helps to generate some mm-hmm. of the kind of the broaden the stakes or broaden the tent kind
right.
of mentality.
Right.
So knowing that most of the people that are sitting in a ward council
mm-hmm.
aren't thinking this way,
no.
How do you introduce or do you have mm-hmm. some suggestions
yeah.
for how to introduce a topic to help people to be less threatened, I
yeah.
guess, by some of the difference in thinking? And even to promote some more of that broad love.
Right. It's not easy. What you're asking is a very, very, very important question. And it's one that I've been racking my brain about for a long, long time. And I do not pretend to have any answers to this other than just having more conversations with one another and bringing it up. And I think it's wonderful that you're a bishop and that you're here and that you're interested in this, because truly, because of our power structure, it's a lot harder for me as a person to do this than it is for you when you have some leadership and some clout. So you talking to your other spiritual leaders, you talking to the stake president, you talking to other people starts to plant a seed, I think. It has to come from someone who is trusted, right? And typically, people in 4 and 5 start looking a little suspect. And it's hard. It's hard. And there are people who are so happy and so safe and having a wonderful life and a wonderful experience in 3, and you don't want to ruin that for people. Development is not something we foist on people. It's not like you say, here is what it looks like, now join us. It really is, you have to have that, and you have to have an idea of how to do that. But people become ready at their own time. The best idea I've come up with is to try to have a separate Sunday school class that is geared toward more of that kind of curriculum that is self-selecting, where people who are ready for that step and are excited about that step might be able to join. I would be really excited to see something like that happen within the walls of the church, so that it's not just we have to go outside of that and be mistrusted to get that kind of spiritual deepening.
So your kind of providing of resources, mm-hmm. I think this is super important, so mm-hmm. I hope that you continue to promote that otherwise, because what you mentioned
too.
About the trusted sources
mm-hmm.
is based on our hierarchy. It has nothing to do with mm-hmm. our qualifications.
That's right.
So a lot like what we were hearing about the seminary.
Yep.
When I was called as a bishop, the first thing that I said was, I don't know how to do half the things you're going to ask me to do,
right.
but I will go find expert resources
right.
to make sure that you actually get someone who can
yeah.
help you, who's trained to do that. I'm here to love you and support you. And really, I think that's what we're all here for.
Absolutely.
But then what do you teach?
Right.
How do you help to kind of raise the bar? And I think what you're doing here is exactly it.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to
yeah.
make sure,
how do I
translate that into a place that becomes less threatening?
So I did a presentation like this that was a little less edgy, even very, 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 very pointed toward Mormons at the North Star Conference. And it went over very, very well. I'm available. If anyone would like me to come to your stake and do a fireside, do some sort of Sunday school class, whatever format, a fifth Sunday, whatever you want, I'm available. And I just think it spreads by ways like this.
Word of mouth.
So come talk to me. I'll give you a card.
Okay, my heart is starting to get going, so
Kay.
I'll put this as concisely as I can.
Yeah.
I think it's really important in mm-hmm. the learning mm-hmm. and mentoring
mm-hmm.
that you're dealing with people who know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Like, there has to be some actual training and mm-hmm. not just within the bubble, because mm-hmm. that's not helpful at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so a special Sunday school class mm-hmm. is an exceptional idea, because that mm-hmm. might be a place that people who are on the edge or outside of the edge at
mm-hmm.
this point
mm-hmm.
can actually have a place.
Right.
But let it be led by someone who knows what they're talking about
mm-hmm.
and is outside of
mm-hmm.
the typical
the paradigm.
200-year mm-hmm. paradigm, because that's not helpful anymore.
That's right.
And it needs to be trained. It needs to be
yeah.
more academic and based in actual theology and not feelings.
So I'm going to push back just a little.
Okay.
Because I think that when we, again, it's getting back to the dual if we're getting too rational about it.
Okay, that's a good
So
point.
Let's, how can we combine it? How can we broaden it and combine
well,
and it with,
and I'm
with,
not
the, with
expecting
the
expecting to eliminate
feelings.
The one, because
yep.
that's also very important.
It is.
Experiential is very important.
Very important.
But
that's essential.
There tends to be such a divide
mm-hmm.
between what I know and
mm-hmm.
how I know it.
Right.
And I don't think it's helpful to eliminate actual training in it. And
agreed.
To be mentored by somebody who, you know, grew up
mm-hmm.
believing and thinking and feeling this, and
mm-hmm.
so I'm going to mentor you in that. It's
mm-hmm.
like, no, thanks. You're waiting for me to get to know what you know, and I'm come and gone from there. Not to put myself in a better
yeah.
place or a worse
yeah.
place. It's just a different place.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I think it is important. I think it's important to have that kind of mentorship, to have as a guidepost. And I think you can have Sunday school classes
mm-hmm.
where people are just exploring and deepening together. You know, it doesn't all have to be. If you rely again too much on the mentors, it's not your journey. So I think it's a combination. I love that.
Thank you for this. This is incredible, by the way.
Thank you.
So what is the difference between shadowing and scapegoating when I get offended by something with my family that I see in myself and being triggered because I'm not allowed to be authentic about my spiritual journey because my family feels my spiritual journey is evil? Or is my reaction to them in regards to my spiritual journey just me living shadowing?
Such a good question, right? It's so hard to, you know, I mean, if someone says something very offensive to you, do I not have the right to get upset about that, right? I mean, that's kind of at the bottom of this, right? It's a both and, okay? It's not an either or, and it's not... it's just not well defined, okay? It's both. So, yes, your parents and your family can be being very offensive. And we also can develop to a point where we recognize that it's a reflection of where they are and not take it personally. But that takes a lot of shadow work to do. So it's a start. It's not an arrival. It is a start to start noticing and being aware of what's happening in those things. And then it takes years. Spiritual work and the spiritual deepening is hard work and it's a long game. But if you do start doing it and maybe, you know, have a coach or a mentor or a therapist or someone to work with in this stuff, it can start to loosen. It can start to loosen. And eventually when they say you're a heretic, where that would have been extremely wounding at one point, as you get clearer on that true self and the ego starts to come down, you can step into that and you can still smile and love and say, I understand that you feel that way and understand that it's really all about them.
I want that.
And not you. Don't we all? It's an end game. It's the ideal. We live in the real world. This is where the rub comes, right? This is the really deep spiritual work is when our humanity is faced with the ideal. And living in that tragic gap between of getting really true acceptance for who we are and holding on to that hope for the ideal. It's really, it's hard, paradoxical work to hold both of those things at the same time.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, this is the last question. Yeah.
My husband and I, luckily, have gone through our faith journey together, and we have 4 kids. Mm-hmm. What are your best tips and suggestions for helping grow our kids spiritually?
Okay. Yeah, that's a whole seminar, isn't it? On parenting. It's one of the number one questions I get from people that I work with in my coaching practice. It's so hard for us to understand this. I will just say this, because I only have a minute. Our tendency as parents is to try to take our place in spiritual and just in growth, development, and want to transfer it directly to our children and infuse them with stage 5 sensibilities from the age of 10. And I just am here to tell you it's not going to happen. The kids are going to go through a selfish phase. It does not mean that they are bad. It doesn't mean that they're going to ruin their lives. It does not mean all of these things that we worry about. It means that they're 5. So hold their stage of development in mind as you have your hopes for them. Where they are today is not going to be where they are in 10, 20 years, and it is normal for them to go through that. Religion and Mormonism does a very, very, very good job of holding children in a nice structure through those phases. And we get really afraid of that as we go through a faith crisis. We're like, geez, this was so painful. But we don't, it's normal for them. They're not going to be able to get non-dual consciousness at their age. They're not going to be able to get this. But who you are will inform them. And as you just give them permission to be who they are, ask them lots of questions and give them structure and values. That doesn't have to be done through a religion. A religion is a good tool for it. You can provide it yourself. That's my best advice is just to recognize that everyone goes through stages of growth. It's normal. Be patient and just be very curious with them. Help them grow into who they are meant to be and help them find themselves. And don't take away all of the hard stuff. The hard stuff is how we grow, right? All right. Thank you so much for the discussion and for your questions. I appreciate it.